From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Max, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June when a man named Tim Ryan noticed something disturbing. People weren't showing up to meetings, or he couldn't get a hold of them by phone or text. People seemed to be disappearing, and he knew they needed help. Tim Ryan is the founder of the nonprofit called A Man in Recovery. His organization helps people who are struggling with alcohol or substance abuse disorder. He works with many people who attend weekly meetings, and during the pandemic, even with the move to outdoor meetings, many people weren't showing. Ryan said in a recent A&E interview that the pandemic has blown a hole in the quality of mental health. He says people who were making connections now feel alone. He says he's noticed people in recovery who had been on a good path, but now they've lost a job, they can't pay rent, they're scared, they're depressed, or they're drinking or using drugs. Ryan said, quote, "You've had a lot of people who have mental health issues who can't get the help they need, or it has fueled underlying mental health issues that people might have been able to hide before the pandemic," end quote. Data from a Kaiser Family Foundation backs Ryan's observations. A Kaiser poll in July showed more than half of U.S. adults reported that their mental health has been negatively impacted due to worry or stress over the coronavirus. That's significantly higher than the 32% reported in March. Research also links social isolation and loneliness to poor mental health and an increase in substance abuse. Back in March, at the beginning of the pandemic, we had a conversation on this program about how to help people who may be isolated and lonely. And as we head back into the cold months without a clear end to the pandemic in sight, those same issues are on the minds of many people. And they are perhaps of particular concern for people who are struggling with mental illness or substance abuse. Maybe you know someone who could benefit from extra support. Maybe you've heard recent conversations on this program about recovery and treatment for mental health and substance abuse disorders during the pandemic, and you would like to seek that kind of help, but you don't know how. This hour, our guests help us understand how to find this kind of emotional or medical support, and we'll tell you about an upcoming community discussion that addresses these issues. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. Kim Brumber is the president and CEO of East House. Kim, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Remind our listeners what East House does in our community.
East House is a behavioral health organization. We serve individuals with mental health or substance use disorders. We're primarily a residential model for long-term recovery.
And Sherry Reed-Watt is one of your team members. She's a residential program director for East House who is living in recovery. Sherry, welcome to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Sabrina May is joining us. She's a program manager for East House's Affinity Place Peer Respite Program, who is also living in recovery. Welcome to you, Sabrina.
Thank you. Thanks for having me as well.
And what's Affinity Place?
Affinity Place is a hospital diversion program. So we're short-term crisis respite to assist individuals that may be in an immediate crisis or facing the possibility of having to utilize the hospital for emergency department services. So we're peers who have lived experience, and we have the ability to share some coping skills if that's what they need, or resources in the community.
And Sabrina and Sherry will be sharing some of those experiences with us this hour. I'm so grateful to have you doing that. I think our listeners really appreciate being able to connect with somebody who understands where they may be coming from, those that struggle with similar issues. So thank you. Also joining us on the line, Dr. Aaron Olden, a physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester. Dr. Olden, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
And I just want to open this up to our listeners. If you are listening to this conversation, maybe you're someone that's been hearing several of the conversations we've had on this program in the past several weeks or months during the pandemic, and you feel like you need help, we're going to talk about resources for you this hour. You can call the program. You can ask to be anonymous. We will help you get through any questions that you may have. Consider this a safe space. I know our guests want to help. You can call the program at 844-295-TALK or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you're more comfortable using email, it's connections@WXXI.org. So, Kim, I'd like to start with you. September is Recovery Month. It comes in the middle of a global pandemic this year. In May, the Kaiser Family Foundation reported that about half of Americans say the coronavirus was harming their mental health, as I mentioned before, and medical professionals across the country have noted an increase in relapses, unsafe uses of alcohol and other substances. What have you and your colleagues at East House been seeing?
Yeah, I would say that is very accurate. You know, in... When the pandemic began, We readily talked about this at our leadership team. And interestingly, for the first probably 8 to 12 weeks or so, we did not see much of an uptick, but it was almost as if as the world and all of us within that realized this was going to be more than a few months that we were going to be living with this, then we really started witnessing the escalation of mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Olden, data shows addiction to alcohol is rising. So is substance abuse and use. The number of overdoses has increased 18% since March, and the number of overdose deaths has increased as well. Some of this has to do with people who are struggling with being isolated or not being able to connect with people as they normally would because of shutdowns or quarantining. What are you concerned about in particular when it comes to these issues?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, that what we're really, you know, struggling with now is not only the pandemic that we're dealing with, but also just this idea of physical distancing. And so, you know, when the guidelines came out that we needed to, quote, social distance, I think a lot of people took that to mean, breaking off connections and not being in communication with those people that support us. So I really have tried to reframe that as, okay, we're being asked to physically distance so that we don't pass the coronavirus along. But we're not being, you know, we don't want to completely socially distance ourselves. That really opens us up to loneliness and to feelings of anxiety and fear and, you know, and that's, I think, when people start to turn to, some of those things that we're trying to help them stay away from.
We'll address that more in depth later this hour, give our listeners some strategies for how to stay connected. One of them is a virtual event that's coming up, and I'd like our listeners to hear more about this opportunity with East House. It connects experts and other community members discussing these subjects. It's a conversation about Silver Linings Playbook. Kim, tell us what's coming up.
So in lieu of our normal in-person luncheon this year, we are doing a series of virtual events, the first of which is the Silver Lining Playbook. It's a movie that can be watched online. And then we have a panel discussion, which is Wednesday night at 7 p.m. And I watched the movie over the weekend, and it is spectacular.
So Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m., you can watch the film on your own that won't be screened at this event. You can find it on Netflix, also on Amazon Prime. I got it at the library. I watched it last night for the first time. It is remarkable. It really generates some what I thought were interesting conversations and a look at the lived experience of these, although they're fictional characters, what a lot of people are struggling with and how to make connections. So I recommend it. This is also an event that's a partnership with the Little Theater. So you can find more information on the East House webpage, on the Little Theater's page. Some of the panelists that will be joining the conversation are Sabrina May. You'll be there on Wednesday night. What would you like people to know?
I just think it's a wonderful opportunity to, like you said, start the discussion, to have a different perspective from what they may or may not know about illness or even living with wellness. And it's a great way to start this conversation if you watch it with your family to also have those kinds of talks.
Part of our goal in this program when we talk about mental health is to destigmatize these conversations. And I think the film raised that point really well. The characters expressed that they were embarrassed about when they were in therapy sessions, having to take medication, if that was something that worked for them, or discussing their diagnoses with family members. But Sabrina, that's not something that we should be embarrassed about. This mental health is health. We should treat it just like physical health. How do you feel about the stigmatization? And do you think that people are being a little more understanding based on conversations we're having during the pandemic?
I think that the opportunity for conversation to be a little bit more available is definitely there. I think that the awareness of mental health grows day to day. I think the film did a great job of showing multiple facets of illness and wellness as a family as a whole. But stigma is real. I do not look like my illness, you know, and so I think that if a person knew or I chose to discuss what my diagnosis was, I get a lot of shocked looks because, you know, I am gainfully employed and I have the honor of working in the field. And that, unfortunately, is not what society has as a vision for those of us who live with mental health.
Sherry, how do you feel about that issue?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, all too often, you know, people immediately go to the stereotype of, you know, the addict or the person with mental illness is somebody who is, you know, homeless on the street. And you know, that does happen, right? But that's not everybody. You know, there's people who may have gone there, like myself, and then, you know, get into recovery and work at wellness and growth, you know. And again, I would agree with Sabrina, you know, being in long-term recovery, when I share my story, people are like, wow, you know, I would not have thought that. So I think, you know, really working to educate people and just break those stereotypes and the stigma is a continuous thing that we do.
As I mentioned, Sherry and Sabrina are both offering to share their stories with us this hour so that we can learn from them and learn how to have conversations with friends or loved ones who may be experiencing something similar. Maybe you are, if you're listening. Sherry, describe the path that led you to where you are now at East House.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started using alcohol and drugs when I was 12. Just, you know, innocent, experimenting, knowing that, you know, it ran in my family, addiction and mental illness ran in my family. You know, and remembering my mom used to tell me all the time, you know, you got to be careful. And, you know, I never thought that it would happen to me. So, you know, I just brushed it off. And as time went on, you know, my drinking got much worse, but I was still functional and, you know, an athlete in high school and college. So I think, you know, again, I wasn't on people's radar as having a problem. And then, you know, put myself around people who were into harder drugs. So, you know, tried cocaine at 18 and then ended up using heroin at 21. And that was, you know, 6 years of going down a downward spiral and where I just got sicker and sicker and lost everything time and again. Had been to detox and inpatient, outpatient programs, residential programs, and pretty much had lost everything, including, you know, material things, my health, had been homeless for a period of time. And, you know, one day I think I just knew in my gut, you know, the people around me were either going to jail or dying. And I knew that if I kept using, it was just going to be a matter of time before it was me. And so it really became life or death for me. And, you know, I went to detox and inpatient for one last time and almost got kicked out, you know, really had some unhealthy behaviors. But had a great counselor, had, you know, people around me that cared and wanted to see me succeed. But it really took a good year and a half, you know. After inpatient, I went to a long-term residential facility that they call therapeutic community and lived there for 19 months. And I needed that time to be away and have my head clear and really work on looking at, you know, the person I was that got me to the point I was at and what I needed to do to change, to become, you know, who I wanted to be. And that took a lot of work, a lot of therapy, a lot of work, you know, asking for help, letting people in, and getting honest. And it's not easy stuff to do.
How did you navigate that? Was there someone that made a difference that helped you push through it? What kinds of conversations did you have with yourself?
Yeah, I mean, always at the end of the day, it was people in my life that stuck with me no matter what. And that wasn't an easy thing to do, you know, because I really had lied to myself so much and everyone else around me that I didn't know the truth from a lie, you know. And so just having those people that were there who pointed that out to me, you know, and would call me out on my stuff, but do so with compassion, you know, and continue to be there for me no matter what, because I knew that they cared. And that was huge for me. If I didn't have those, you know, key people, I think it would have been much harder for me to get into recovery and stay in recovery.
If you had to, if you were communicating with a family who perhaps had someone that they love in a similar situation to the one that you were in, what would you tell them? What would you want them to know? Because this is not just about, you said you went to inpatient treatment and the long-term residential treatment. You're working on yourself. You have a team of medical experts helping you. But that interpersonal interaction that you have with friends and family, it sounds, was very important to you. What would you want families to know if they have someone in their family who is struggling?
You know, to stay the course, as hard as it can be, and that doesn't mean, I guess I should clarify, it doesn't mean enabling the person, right? I had family members who would have loved me to death if I let them, you know, and I had to stop the enabling with them, you know, because this is a family disease, right? We think that it's just the person with the addiction, and it's not. You know, it's the family becomes codependent on that person and may enable behaviors or give them money or, and so everybody's got to change that family dynamic and, you know, and get healthy around it. And so, it's tough to stick with people, you know. Family members, went through a lot with me, you know, and, it's not easy to watch somebody that you love, you know, destroy themselves and make poor choices. But, you know, at the end of the day, knowing that I had people that cared was a huge thing for me. And that was family and some of the providers that stuck with me. So,
was there a point in your inpatient treatment or the long-term residential program where you felt like you had turned a corner? These are issues that probably affect you in different ways throughout your life, but was there a moment or a period of time where you felt like you were making some progress, you were proud of yourself, and you were ready to take the next step?
Yeah, I think cautiously I felt like, okay, you know, maybe I can do this recovery thing. I say cautiously because there have been times in the past where, you know, I had attempted to get into recovery and I got cocky with it, you know, like I got this. And I think that's a dangerous place for anyone in recovery to go to, because you never have it. It's a lifelong journey. Recovery is a daily thing that you do. It's a daily reprieve. You know, I've seen people with 15, 16 years go back out and they don't make it back in. You know, because they either end up in jail or they die. So I have a healthy respect for addiction and mental illness. And, you know, it's just something that you have to have a constant awareness of and be on top of. Just like taking medicine, right? If you're a diabetic or you have heart issues, you take your medicine every day. And people in recovery from addictions and mental illness, you know, we also need to do that. So,
how has the pandemic affected that journey for you? Do you feel like you were pushed in different directions because of isolation, or perhaps you felt lonely? What worries you the most about your personal journey now that we're living in this time?
It's definitely made me get creative. You know, I'm grateful that I am in long-term recovery, you know, 20 plus years. But even then, you know, this pandemic has been tough. I go to meetings, you know, and not able to do that in person anymore. And although I'm grateful that they're there, it's not the same as that, you know, face-to-face connection with folks. And So, you know, I can only imagine, right, for people new to recovery, that it's difficult because we're social beings and we need to connect with other people, especially when we're in recovery. And so, you know, I have the tools in my toolbox. I know what I need to do, and I do it. And so, you know, I know if I'm not in a good space, you know, emotionally or mentally, I know how to reach out to folks. But that was, you know, it's not always easy to do that, especially in early recovery.
You've spoken about loving yourself and practicing forgiveness. We talked a little offline about your story and showing compassion for yourself and for others. I think that can be hard for many of us to do at times, whether you are struggling with a mental health or substance abuse issue or not. What do you want people to know about how you found to love yourself?
It was a long journey, you know. I didn't in the beginning, and I think, you know, nobody turns to drugs and alcohol because they feel great about themselves. And certainly when it gets to a point where it's an addiction, you know, things happen, you'll do things that don't help that self-love at all. So it's just a real downward spiral. And so it took many years and surrounding myself with people who their only, you know, thing that they wanted for me was to see me healthy and happy and to trust that. You know, I think when you're in an addiction, you really question people and you can't trust them, you know. And so just really, it's a journey. And doing things, you know, that are esteemable acts, right? And so that help you increase your self-esteem and that self-love. But it's tough, you know, and I suffered from perfectionism too, you know. Everything, I had to do it right. And if I didn't, well, then I'm just not worthy, you know. And really needing to change that around and just say, you know what, this is a process. You're in a growth process, and you're going to make mistakes. But, you know, you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep moving forward.
I think East House is so lucky to have you as someone who can provide that peer support. And Sabrina, I'm sure the same is true for you. The conversation that we've had so far, I think you're both remarkable, and I really appreciate having you here. Sabrina, tell us about your journey to East House.
So I, much like Sherry, began using at a very young age, but I actually started to have manifestations of mental health symptoms before I picked up the drink or the drug. I came from a family that was very religiously inclined, and so conversations about mental health or even drug use, even though it was something that was, you know, exhibited in my family, was not really discussed. So I was predominantly raised by my grandmother. We spent a lot of time in church, and it was kind of like we were going to pray our way through it. We were going to go to the altar, you know, but God was going to fix it. And so as I got into my mid-teens, I began to use substances to kind of make myself feel normal, per se, fit in. I felt like I could think better, you know, a little bit clearer. I played sports in school. I was a straight-A student. I actually graduated with a scholarship to college. But once I didn't have that constant support or people that I knew and felt safe with while I was in high school, that's when my addiction really took flight, because I didn't have anyone to talk about the mental health issues with. And so I actually left home at that time, or actually was put out of home at that time because of behaviors that I was stealing and such from my family members, and my grandmother just couldn't take it anymore. I suffered with homelessness and in and out of hospitals, several suicide attempts, multiple inpatient stays. I'm not originally from upstate, so I moved from county to county. I went inpatient in most counties that I lived in. And I would have long periods of time away from drugs and be going to my program and think that this time was the final time. And I have children, and I would bring my children home, and I was not prepared. I was not prepared to help them deal with the issues that had accumulated from living with someone with illness, and also to help them navigate situations that they had encountered while not being in my care. And so then I would resort back to what it was that I knew that would make it all go away again. I did that for many years. And for me, it really wasn't family that helped me navigate myself to wellness. It was actually a provider who said that I'd pretty much tried everything, so why not try a trauma group? And so that was my first introduction to the word trauma and trauma work and what that meant for me and my life. And I actually did about 2.5 years of trauma work and found out that there were some things I had suppressed, some things that I just did not want to talk about, some things that I was taking responsibility for, that decisions that were made for me by adults that I had no control over. And it was with that work that I was able to move into a point of wellness and move forward with my recovery.
How were you introduced to the trauma program? Was it through the provider that you mentioned, or it seems like,
yeah.
Tell us about that provider. It seems like that person really made a difference in your journey.
She is actually in this county, and she just would not give up. I would stop coming to group because maybe I had used and I was embarrassed because my clean time was constantly changing and I didn't want to take medication because my diagnosis had been changed so many times over the years, and I had kind of given up hope. My last suicide attempt, actually I was walking with my youngest son, and he actually, fireman carried me to St. Mary's because I had just passed out on him, because I had decided that my children would be better with someone else, that someone could love them better than I could. And so she just wouldn't let me go. She just kept saying, just come to group. It doesn't matter if you use, just come to group. And that's when the trauma program began at Evelyn Brandon. And that's where my journey really began.
That is powerful, Sabrina. And what you mentioned about your kids, how is everybody now? How are you? How are your kids? How's your relationship?
My children have, a couple of them are working on their own wellness. Fortunately, they have a mom that's been through the gauntlet. So, you know, we live in a judgment-free zone, and I just kind of help them navigate as best as I can, because their journey is their journey. I can't change their path for them. They're adults. So I just give them the resources and keep loving them, just like, you know, someone cared about me. I also have the dubious honor of being a grandparent of 5 grandchildren right now. 2 of which live in my home. So I have the opportunity to be there for them, to be an active participant, to be present, to love them and let them know that they are loved, and keep them safe, which is very important for me.
How has the pandemic affected your journey? Do you find it difficult to stay on the path because of quarantining, isolation, any of these physically distant guidelines that we have? What worries you, if anything?
For me, the pandemic has been interesting because the part of East House I work in, which is short-term crisis respite, has continued to be open during the pandemic. So we did not close because we are a crisis resident. And what bigger crisis are we in than the pandemic right now? And so I had the ability to continue to give back on a daily basis what was freely given to me, which is a blessing. I'm full of gratitude with that. And I also am pretty lucky, you know, I have a therapist that I'm able to reach out to, you know, via phone or online. I have a very strong spiritual base that I can tap into, a group of people that are just really wonderful. And my family now, because along the road, some of them took the time to learn about what was really going on, and have become a major support for me at this time.
That is incredible. I'm so glad to hear that you and your family are doing well, Sabrina. The same for you, Sherry. Thank you for being here. Kim, hearing your team share their stories and knowing what they're contributing to East House, how does that make you feel?
Well, I feel incredibly proud. I mean, I get to see every day how all that they have experienced in life informs their work and makes them excellent at the care for the people in our service. And I couldn't be prouder than to have these two on the team, because they're both extraordinary women.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll take our very short break in a moment. When we come back, we have some emails from listeners who would like to ask all of our guests for some guidance, some tips to help navigate the cold months coming up, knowing that perhaps we're going to be a little more isolated, a little more separated. We won't be able to be outdoors quite as much. So I know our guests will have some valuable information to share. A quick reminder about the event that's coming up on Wednesday. It's called, if I can find all my notes, a Conversation About Silver Linings Playbook. It's not the film screening. Make sure you see the film in advance. But it will be a panel discussion about mental health stigma, lived experiences of several of the people who will be participating, and then about the film itself, what we can learn from it. It is a free event. You can find more on the East House website, on the Little Theater's website as well. It'll be screened on the Little's Facebook page. We'll ask Kim a few more details when we come back from our short break. But listeners, again, you can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Or you can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. More connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on the Next Connections. On Sunday, the New York Times reported it had obtained President Trump's long-concealed tax returns. The documents show more than two decades of tax information, and according to the Times, it reveals, quote, struggling properties, vast write-offs, and hundreds of millions in debt coming due, end quote. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston joins us to talk about what we've learned and all the impacts it may have. Talk to you Tuesday. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today on Connections. Thank you for listening. We're talking to guests associated with an event at East House coming up on Wednesday. Kim Brumber is the president and CEO of East House. Sherry Reed-Watt is a residential program director for East House, who's living in recovery. Sabrina May is the program manager for East House Affinity Place Peer Respite Program, who is living in recovery. And Dr. Aaron Olden is a physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester. Dr. Olden, a question for you. I'd like to read some data from the University of Michigan Addiction Center. It reports that COVID-19-related social isolation and stress can increase susceptibility to substance misuse, addiction, and relapse, and substance abuse can lead to immune system, respiratory, and pulmonary changes that may increase susceptibility to COVID-19, as well as complications. So a number of factors there that can be influenced by social isolation during this pandemic. When you look ahead to the cold months, Dr. Olden, and you know many people may be more isolated or perhaps dealing with a second wave and a possible future shutdown, what can we be doing now to prepare for it and prevent some of those consequences?
Sure. So I think that, first of all, I just really want to thank Sherry and Sabrina for sharing their stories. I think it's really important for everyone, including listeners, to understand that, you know, we're not alone, those of us that struggle with these with these issues. To sort of answer to your question, I can't remember if it was Sherry or Sabrina, but one mentioned having a toolbox. And I really like that term. I try to encourage my patients to think about, you know, what is in your toolbox of therapies or of activities that help you to feel better, that help you to deal with feelings of worry or loneliness or grief. And so as we head into the colder months, and you're right, we're, you know, probably going to be spending more time inside just by nature of what the Rochester winter is like, start to think about what things fuel you and what things you can rely on when you are starting to feel, a little bit perhaps lonely or isolated.
Sherry, I think you had mentioned your toolbox. I'm sure the toolbox is different for everyone, but what do you have in your toolbox?
I mean, one of the big things for me is structure to my day. You know, so whatever that is for somebody, you know, whether it's a job, volunteering, anything that is helpful and keeps somebody busy. And then, you know, again, connection. I'm a big connection person, and so I've had to find different ways to connect with people and my supports. You know, I will try to embrace winter and bundle up and still do some winter activities, but meditation is a big one for me, just really clearing my mind and breathing. And then, you know, limiting my news intake has been huge and made a big difference. For a while, I would, you know, watch all the news I could. And I noticed that it was really not a good thing for me. And so I've kind of pulled back on that. And I just watch enough to stay informed. But then I limit that. And that goes for social media also. But then, you know, on some level, it's important for me to get outside of myself and help somebody else. I think anytime I do that, it's, you know, I'm grateful for where I'm at, and I'm always willing to help somebody else in their journey. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, having gratitude is a big deal and part of my toolbox also.
Sabrina, what's in your toolbox?
I think I agree with Sherry, structure for sure. I kind of start my day off. I have certain readings that I like to do in the morning to kind of get myself focused and centered for the day. I also am a firm believer in honoring my body. If I am tired, it is okay to lie down or take a nap. It is okay to go to bed early. I don't have to, if I said I was going to, let's just say, do this thing at 8 o'clock and it doesn't get done, it is okay. I appreciate walking. I am learning to get out and walk. I even do it on my lunch break now, and appreciate the leaves and just feeling the air and the sun, whatever that is. Also staying connected with women who are in recovery as well, especially women who have been in the process longer than me. So that this way, you know, I can kind of bounce things off of people sometimes, because sometimes when I stay in my own head, that's not a great place to be by myself. So having other people to talk to, and I am a journaler, and I collage journals. So I like to cut words and pictures out in journal and then write around them. And a lot of times the pictures and the words will just fall in line with whatever it was I was going to write for that day. And gratitude and giving back, just like Sherry said, on a daily basis, just remembering where I came from is so important to me.
Here's a message from a listener who will remain anonymous. I can say that this listener experienced a major loss in his life recently, and he says, "It's hard to tell at various times the difference between depression and sadness. I think being constantly tired is the depression, feeling totally unmotivated, I'm more assigning to sadness. I used to bike 10 to 15 miles on Sunday. It now requires a Herculean effort to bring my bike up from the basement. I need to start thinking of baby steps and how to get myself moving again. Do your guests have any suggestions? Kimma, I'll start with you.
Well, I think the listener is spot on that it is about baby steps and being gentle with ourselves. You know, with grief, my belief is grief never goes away. We just learn to live with whatever the changes that has created the grief, and finding ways to allow ourselves to honor the whatever or whoever it is that we lost, I think is very important. And then celebrating when we do take those baby steps. You know, maybe it's oiling the chain on the bike in the basement. And you don't get it up the stairs, and that is okay in knowing that, but not putting too much pressure on yourself. We have to be kind to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Olden, do you have any advice for our listener?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I would say is I'm glad that the listener reached out. I think it's so important when we are going through a difficult time to be able to process the emotions that we're feeling and not feel that we are alone in that process. I would encourage them to have a discussion with their primary care provider, because yes, we do know that after losing a loved one at a stage of grief, there is, you know, that's a normal feeling, sadness and grief. But we do really want to be careful to distinguish that from what one would call, you know, clinical depression, when those symptoms start to interfere with our activities during the day. We find it difficult to get out of bed. We lose time at work. So I would, you know, encourage anyone that's, you know, having those sorts of symptoms to just, you know, to reach out and have a discussion, even if it's over a telehealth visit, to help put things into perspective and understand where you fall within that spectrum, and then just come up with a plan together to focus on, you know, again, to use that word, what the toolbox, what that toolbox might be for you, what things for you help you to become more renewed and more centered.
I see the phone starting to ring with listeners with their questions and comments. And up first is Joyce in Rochester. Go ahead, Joyce.
Hi. I just want to say I am not a therapist, nor am I a person in recovery. But as people were talking today on the show about a toolbox and a toolbox, things that work for us, I'm involved with a wonderful program that goes into the Monroe County Jail. And the program I help co-facilitate is called Houses of Healing. The four spiritual truths that program is based on is exactly what people are talking about today, that I am loved and I am lovable, that I am fundamentally good and beautiful, that I am worthy of respect and acceptance, and that I am needed to help heal the world. And in order to heal the world, we, of course, have to begin with ourselves. But once we are at a place of health and healing, I would highly suggest purposeful giving back activities. And Houses of Healing is a marvelous program. I wished I had invented it, created it, but I didn't. But it comes out of from a woman out of Boston. It is a superb program. And I have learned something about myself every week that I go in and co-facilitate the program. So find something purposeful and meaningful to do, and know whether you are in recovery or your loved one is in recovery, that this type of work is so, so beneficial for the world.
Joyce, thank you so much for sharing that. We really appreciate it. And Sabrina and Sherry, I'll ask you to weigh in on that, because you're both doing work for an organization where you can support people who understand your experience, you understand theirs. Has that helped your own journey? Sherry, I'll start with you.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like what, you know, Joyce suggested. And the language is a bit different than, you know, your typical 12-step program, but it all really, you know, goes to the same outcome, right? To love yourself, to heal, to become better and grow. So I really like what she had to say.
Sabrina, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I will share that I have the honor of working for East House, but I am also an East House alumni from many years ago. So being in a position to be able to give back to the women and men that come through this organization is an honor for me.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Here's an email from another listener sharing a personal experience. She says, I have depression and anxiety that I deal with, and I've had a rough year or so with anxiety pre-pandemic. A lot of changes in my life, including living on my own the first time, and that exacerbated all of this. The loneliness gets hard. I don't even have a pet, but I'm thinking of getting one. I do see my mom, who lives in the same apartment complex as I do, and that helps, but I miss my friends. I also take things more seriously than some people, so I've skipped out on some family gatherings. What has helped is being able to continue to see my new therapist via remote sessions, but I do need to find some new hobbies and activities at home and need more people to reach out to. Dr. Olden, as you said about the other listener who reached out, you're glad that they're seeking some kind of connection. They're asking for help. It must, you know, we're living in a society that values independence perhaps too much sometimes, where asking for help can be hard. What would you tell this listener?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think even just having listened to this conversation and hearing Sherry and Sabrina talk and understanding that, you know, I would venture to say that we all struggle in some ways with waves of emotion as we've gone through this pandemic. And if I could just briefly, just to touch base on the toolbox again, I think one thing that has really helped me frame this for my patients is a quick little structure that I use. It's using the letter P, three P's: process, people, and purpose. And, you know, I think in a way that's what we're hearing in these conversations today. So process being, we need to talk about these emotions. We do much better when we get these emotions out than when we hold them in. What things help me process? And ask yourself that question. Is it journaling? Is it maybe meditation? You know, using a meditation app, many of which are free during the pandemic. So being able to process those emotions. And then people. So we're hearing about connecting with others, connecting with pets, connecting with people, connecting with a relative, you know, maybe thinking about reaching out to someone you haven't talked to in a while, or a spiritual group, or the virtual theater that we've been talking about. So, you know, that gets a bit to people, and I would probably lump in movement with that too. So taking a walk or just getting outside and getting into nature. So that would be the people, and then purpose. You know, Sherry mentioned how it really helped her actually to help someone else. And we actually know through research that that gratitude and giving back is good for our health. So finding some purpose, you know, connecting to what's important, what feels good to you, really can help us to sort of move through this. So I sort of like that because it gives structure to the toolbox. It's process, it's people, and it's purpose. And that sometimes helps us to think about and wrap our heads around, how do we get through this?
Mm-hmm. We're down to our last few minutes, and I have a question about people who may be struggling with some of these issues. They're working. Maybe they feel like their companies don't quite understand what they're going through. Tim Ryan, the man I mentioned in the introduction to this program, who works with the nonprofit A Man in Recovery, says that too many American companies don't know how to work with someone that is truly in crisis with addiction, alcoholism, or mental health. And he points out that employees should be able to consult with outside providers or interventionists. More companies are starting to allow this, but too often they don't educate their employees about privacy and where they can seek help. Kim, what do you think about that? Do you agree?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, more and more we're seeing organizations subscribe to some type of employee assistance programs, which is a door for an employee. But yes, there's also often a very limited perspective on how or if to support individuals with mental illness or substance use disorders. So I think that's very, very accurate. Unfortunately, it leaves many of us to figure that out on our own.
Mm-hmm. We're down to our last few minutes. As I said, I think it's important to talk about resources. So I'll ask each of you, what for one or two resources you would like listeners to know about if they feel like they need help connecting or they need some kind of emotional or even medical support. Kim, where would you point people?
You know, many different, whether it's a trauma group, addiction group, just a general like gender-based support group, many of those have gone virtual because of the pandemic. So I would start with online.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Search online for something that sounds like it might be a fit. Sabrina, what would you say?
I would say you could try Warm Lines. Affinity Place actually runs a peer-run Warm Line that's available to anyone in the community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But Warm Lines or text call lines are very helpful during this time.
Mm-hmm. And Sherry, same question.
Yeah, I would agree with what Kim and Sabrina said, along with, you know, sometimes there's meetup groups, which I know is probably limited due to the pandemic, but if it's outside or, you know, with the cold weather coming, if you don't like the cold, maybe, you know, meetups at the mall where you can walk with somebody and keep the physical distance, but still, you know, have the face-to-face contact. So.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Olden, what would you recommend?
Yeah, I certainly agree with everything that has been said already. I would encourage people, given my focus on mindfulness, to seek out a meditation app that works for you. We know Headspace is actually currently free for all New Yorkers and healthcare workers. There's another one out there called 10% Happier. And there's a lot of free virtual wellness classes online. So in a unique time that we are finding ourselves being isolated, it's almost more accessible than it was before to get into some of these groups and these apps that are now free.
And where can people learn more about Mindful Medicine Rochester?
Sure. You can head to my website. It's mindfulmed.com. Also on, same thing on Facebook and Instagram. Be happy to speak with anyone.
Well, listeners, remember the event on Wednesday is from 7 to 8 p.m. It's a conversation about the film Silver Linings Playbook. Make sure you watch the film in advance if you haven't seen it before, because it won't be screened during the event, because they will be using that hour very productively with a panel of experts talking about mental health, stigma, lived experiences. Sabrina will be on that panel. Some other wonderful experts and people with lived experience in the community. So again, that event is free. You can learn more on the East House website or on the Little Theater's Facebook page. Again, Wednesday from 7 to 8. And I want to thank all of my guests so much for joining us today. These are important conversations that we will keep having, especially as we enter the winter months, without much information about when things may be back to what we call quote unquote normal. But we always appreciate hearing from people like Kim Brumber, president and CEO of East House. Thank you so much, Kim.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
And my gratitude to Sherry Reed Watt, residential program director for East House, who's living in recovery. Thank you so much, Sherry. I'm glad you're doing well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Same with Sabrina May. Thank you so much. Program manager for East House Affinity Place, living in recovery. Thank you, Sabrina.
Thank you.
And Dr. Aaron Olden, owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And my thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, who's back with us today after a long stretch on Second Opinion, which you can watch in the winter. Thanks, Rob. Thanks to Rah Rah Riot and Barsook Records celebrating 10 years this summer. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. He'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.